thank you everybody for coming here today. I'm actually not a cattle biologist at all. I'm a plant geneticist. And so you might be wondering, how does something like me that works on plants look like I'm And so I did a little research into this and found a relationship that I think is pretty interesting. I like that. And cows like plants. So I'm a plant geneticist. So I think there's a synergistic relationship there that we can work with. And it turns out also we all have DNA, and that DNA is all regulated, and into that plays this thing that we call epigenetics. So just kind of as a brief outline, first I'm going to give kind of a basic rundown of epigenetics and epigenomics, what these terms mean, really some of the basic concepts. And then I'll briefly talk about various methods of analysis and how these can be used. And then finally, I'll kind of come to what does the future look like in terms of potential applications, and then finally conclude. I do have to apologize, though, that a lot of the examples I will be talking about in here either come from plant biology, not just because I'm a plant biologist, but it turns out this is actually one of the areas, epigenetics, where plant biology is kind of ahead of the curve. And so some of the best examples really come from that field. And then also, of course, a lot of the great examples out there come from model systems like mice or from human biology, because clearly that's where the money, big money is for this sort of research. Oh, my slides are ahead. I apologize for that. That's fine. I can try to keep it under control. So I really became interested in epigenetics and epigenomics when I learned about some of these really fascinating phenomena. And so up there in the top left-hand corner is a picture of these various different colors of corn seeds. And what's going on here is there's a phenomenon called paramutation, where when you make a cross of two different corn varieties, one variety can actually induce a heritable change in the other one that's not due to differences in genetics. And then below that, there's another great one. The classic examples of epigenetics in mice is really this, what's known as the Agouti gene. And this is a great example of really environmental influences on the regulation of the genome. And I'll talk a little bit about that later. But I think it's important to really study the epigenome because, as biologists trying to understand the interplay between the environment and genotype, how this translates into phenotype, the epigenome is really there at the juncture of two of these relationships. And that's kind of how the environment interacts with the genotype, and then ultimately how genotype is translated into phenotype. So what is this term epigenetics? Well, it comes back, the first person who coined the term was a famous British developmental biologist, C.H. Waddington. And back in, and he was really interested in this idea of epigenesis, and that's a very old word going back to the Greek philosophers. But basically, it's the concept of how does an organism develop from a rather undifferentiated state, your embryos, into a fully developed organism with different organs, different cell types, and so on, from this exact same genetic material. And so Waddington coined this term in 1942 of epigenetics, and alongside this concept of an epigenetic landscape, to really kind of get at this question of how do cells differentiate and become very distinct from one another, even though genetically they're identical. And so the whole idea of essentially this landscape is that you're starting up here, if you imagine this landscape as a series of hills and valleys. Up here you have an undifferentiated pluripotent cell that is capable of basically differentiating into all the various cell types within your body. And as it goes along, it gets trapped in these valleys. And so if you imagine these valleys are differentiated states of, say, like a skin cell versus a neuron, The cell basically becomes trapped in these states, and then it can't really move into a neighboring valley and become something different. And he came up with this idea back in 1942, and since then we've gone on to really confirm a lot of this concept in a molecular fashion. And he did this before it was really even understood that genes, how genes acted or behaved. So here we have embryonic stem cells, which then can become these lineage-specific stem cells. So at this point, you've lost in that pluripotency, and you further differentiate into kind of your terminal,
fully differentiated stem cells.
Well, the term epigenetics is something that's kind of evolved over time. And for better or for worse, I think to some extent it's gone a little too far, because now it's become almost a confusing a term that's used in a very confusing way as kind of a catch-all for almost everything under the sun. But where I kind of stand on this definition is really, I kind of ended with Holliday. And so Robin Holliday is a famous molecular biologist. One of the things he's best known for is really understanding how strands of DNA exchange during meiosis. And this is called the Holliday junction. In 1975, and so he was studying really how DNA is regulated. In 1975, he proposed that DNA methylation could be a mechanism for the regulation of gene expression. And some years later, after kind of spending a long time working on DNA methylation, he proposed two different definitions of epigenetics that really kind of expanded the definition in a very useful way. The first definition is that it's a study of changes in gene expression which occur in organisms with differentiated cells, the mitotic inheritance of given patterns of gene expression. So this long slew of words is really kind of going back to Waddington's original definition of really cell division, how cells become locked into these differentiated states. He then expanded the definition to one of nuclear inheritance, which is not based on differences in DNA sequence. And so this definition really encompasses that first definition, where if you think of mitosis and cell division as a form of going from one generation of a cell to the next, it includes that, but it also expands it to include inheritance across meiosis, across transgenerationally across individuals. And that definition is really, I think, where a lot of the current interest is, or in a lot of the hype, even if it's not founded, is really at. So at this point, I'm going to introduce yet another term which has relation to epigenetics, and confusingly is called epigenomics, or the epigenome, yet the two are actually quite distinct. And so the epigenome is what I define to be those factors that interact with the genome, defining regions of heterochromatin and euchromatin. So heterochromatin being these regions of the genome that are packed up tightly in silence where genes and other factors are not being expressed, and euchromatin being those open regions of the genome where most of your genes are, and these are where your genes can now be turned on and expressed. And it includes a variety of different factors. So one of the best studied and best known is DNA methylation. This is the addition of, this is a chemical modification that's made to the DNA itself, but yet doesn't change the underlying sequence. And in addition to that, there has, in the last few years, been discovered to be other sorts of modifications on top of that DNA methylation in mammals. And that includes things like hydroxymethylation. It also includes all those various proteins that directly interact with the DNA, that the DNA wraps around. And these are histones. And they form, and these different histone proteins come together and form structures called nucleosomes that the DNA is wrapped around. It's how the DNA is packaged. In addition, these histones have various types of chemical modifications that are made to them, that are reversible, so you can add and remove these different modifications. And these modifications help define different regions of active chromatin, such as genes, and inactive closed-off regions of heterochromatin. And then I also include in this non-coding RNAs, things such as small RNAs, or earlier Jerry Taylor mentioned this lethal allele that turned out to be a long non-coding RNA. Some of these factors, really depending on how you look at it, could be considered part of the epigenome. So one of the key messages I always try to get across when I talk about epigenomics is this idea that context matters. Because there's a lot of perceptions out there in terms of what factors like DNA methylation do or don't do. It's a common perception that DNA methylation is always going to silence or turn off a gene, and that doesn't be the case. At the most basic level, context really matters in terms of factors such as sequence differences. And so in plants where I work, DNA methylation is found in three different sequence contexts. That's the best known is the CG or CBG methylation. This is a dinucleotide site. That is, my apologies for, I don't know why it's jumping back and forth like this, but we can try to work around that. But then there's also these two other trinucleotide sequence contexts, CHG and CHH. And here, the letter H represents all those other sequences except for G. In animals, there's only really two main sequence contexts, and that's CPG, which is also found in plants, and then this just generic CH type of methylation that's been discovered only in the last probably 3 or 4 years. And the reason why we bother to separate out methylation in terms of its underlying sequence is that this has different functional consequences and is oftentimes established and maintained by different types of enzymes. So there are very functional and molecular differences in terms of what these contexts mean. And this is just a study where they're trying to go through a bunch of different mammalian studies and really identify some of the key sequence differences in where they're finding methylation. And this context also really matters in terms of its effects on gene expression. So on the left here, this is one of my figures really looking at how different patterns of methylation within genes can have different effects on gene expression. So this doesn't apply to beef cattle, but what I think it really illustrates here is that when you start looking at individual genes, you can find very divergent patterns of methylation, and in particular in these different contexts within the gene bodies. And this has very different consequences when you look at how these genes are being expressed. So surprisingly, this one pattern of methylation that's found in gene bodies actually is associated with very highly expressed genes. And it turns out when you look at mammals, it's also the case that a lot of your most highly expressed genes, these genes that are turned on all the time, actually have high levels of methylation within the gene body itself. And so, but this turns out to be different if that methylation is found within promoter regions upstream of the gene, those regions that are really regulating how that gene is turned on or turned off. And so it's very important in analyzing this data to take into consideration these contextual differences. Now, earlier I mentioned kind of these different histones, and there's this whole theory out there about a histone code that you have in terms of regulating genes, that you have all these different types of histones themselves, and then all these different modifications that can be made in a reversible manner to the histone, and that these are associated with those changes in gene expression. So understanding how all this fits together really gets it kind of like, again, as Jerry Taylor was saying earlier, that one of the limitations that they have, and appears to be the case in understanding the beef cattle genome, is really what are these regulatory regions and how are they operating? And so trying to get at all, you know, identifying where these regions of methylation and histones and histone modifications are is really essential to answering that question. And to get at that, there's actually quite a few different techniques, whether you're looking at DNA methylation, whether you're looking at histones and their various modifications, This flow chart up here is just looking at different methods for DNA methylation analysis, and as you can see, there's quite a few different techniques. And really, what is the appropriate way, depends on the question you're trying to answer. Where the field is kind of really going at right now is really methods of looking at these changes, modifications across the entire genome using either array, microarray-based methods, or whole genome sequencing methods. And these really depend upon, in terms of DNA methylation, on this one chemical bisulfite, which when you treat isolated DNA with bisulfite, unmethylated sites undergo a chemical change. And so when you sequence them or apply them to an array, they're actually read as a T rather than a C. And this allows us to then apply them to using either PCR, more traditional sequencing methods, microarrays, or different methods of like next-gen sequencing to really map these modifications across the entire genome. And what's really become exciting in the last few years is earlier I asked about some of these long-read technologies like PacBio and Oxford Nanopore. And there's methods under development to be able to use these technologies to identify methylated regions without undergoing this bisulfite conversion. And then using this long-read technology gives us a lot of capabilities to really start answering questions that were not previously possible. And in terms of trying to study and understand histones, there's the whole set of questions as well. There's ways of looking at nucleosome occupancy, and so this can distinguish regions of open chromatin versus regions of closed chromatin. And so if you're wanting to try to identify potential regulatory regions that might be important and associated with some QTL, one of these techniques would possibly be very useful. And if you're trying to distinguish between various types of modifications, the key technology is chromatin immune precipitation, where you use an antibody to pull down regions that these histones are found, and then you can again apply them to either a microarray or do sequencing to really identify where in the genome these regions are. So that's basically how we usually analyze this sort of data. Now I kind of want to get into the really interesting part, and that's what are some of the potential applications of this technology, of this field? And here's kind of my mandatory picture of a beef cow, just to keep everybody interested, because we're not going to talk about those. But some of the potential applications, really, that are coming out is there's potential applications in terms of selection and breeding. Applications, perhaps, in terms of trying to predict performance. And then ultimately, a lot of the work that I'm trying to do is how do you go about creating novel epigenomic variation, whether it be through environmental means or rather through various techniques of epigenomic engineering. And so, to diverge and talk about plants for a little bit, I really think that, so in terms of selection and breeding, kind of one of the key work out there that's really kind of put this as a possibility came out of a little model plant called Arabidopsis, where the authors of this work used a very innovative trick. They used since Arabidopsis is a very inbred plant, so you can take this plant and it's virtually isogenic. It has very low, for each accession of it, there's not going to be any segregating genetic variation, or very little of it. And so you can take a related line that is genetically identical, except for a single mutation, in one of these key enzymes that is involved in maintaining the epigenome. And then by crossing both your wild type and your mutant, you can induce massive changes in things like DNA methylation across the entire genome. You then either back cross or just go to the F2 and identify those
plants that have that are homozygous for the non-mutant allele. And then you treat it as if you're making a recombinant inbred line, so you just keep crop, just keep selecting it. And what you end up in the end with is this population of plants that are genetically identical to each other, whereas the only difference between them is really differences in different regions of methylation. And then you can start looking at the phenotypes that arise from that. And so when you do this in Arabidopsis, what you find is if you start looking at phenotypes such as flowering type of plant types, here is the original wild, here's the original mutant parent, here's the original wild-type parent in terms of the variation in that trait. What you see is that within these epiroles, there's a much greater range of variation for that trait. And so the idea here is that all this variation that you're seeing is really coming from these epigenetic differences rather than genetic differences. And then using the DNA methylation differences as markers, just as you would a genetic marker, you can start doing things like QTL mapping, just like you would when looking for genetically based traits. So all that's very cool. And if I have you excited in any way of how this could possibly apply, let me throw a little cold water on that. And that's because plants are very different from animals in terms of their biology and how they establish and maintain the epigenome. Plants, when they're going through sex and sexual reproduction, maintain the epigenetic state through the gametes and into the next generation. So this is really allows for a lot of epigenetic phenomena to be discovered in plants. Animals, on the other hand, don't do that. They wipe out the epigenome and then reestablish it. So they erase the genome. And they do this not just once, but they do it twice. They tend to do it during first, early on in zygote formation, and then later on during embryo development. And so in order for transgenerational epigenetics to really be a thing in animals, that difference in the epigenome somehow has to survive these two rounds of resetting. And so this is one reason, probably the primary reason, why epigenetic phenomena in animals seems to be so rare. And to really start answering questions about is this possible to be applied in animals, I think we need to understand better, one, is it possible really for, you know, an epigenetic variant to survive this resetting? And if two, if so, how often, how frequently does it occur, and what are the conditions under which it can occur? There's another aspect about this that's also important. And that's a lot of the work, especially at a population level that's come out in the last few years, shows that there's a very strong relationship between genetic variation and also variation across the So this is work from postdoctoral advisor back. He was a postdoc, and he was looking at variation in methylation across hundreds of different Arabidopsis accessions. So these were scattered from, collected from all across the world. They're very genetically distinct. And in terms of the DNA methylation, they're also very distinct. And since you have this population of genetically distinct and epigenetically distinct plants, you can treat things like the DNA methylation as a trait and start doing QTL, like GWAS, and mapping methyl QTL, trying to identify genetic differences that explain some of the variation in the epigenome itself. When you do that, you find, at least kind of in this initial work, that at least 35% of the differences, these DMRs, or differentiating methylated regions, are associated with an MQTO or genetic variant, suggesting that they're not truly epigenetic, but being driven by genetic differences. And it's very likely that that's actually an underestimate due to the limitations that were inherent in this work. So it's actually probably much higher than that. And more recently, similar work from human population studies has basically found much the same thing, that a lot of the differences in terms of DNA methylation between individuals oftentimes is due, or at least associates with, genetic differences. And what this possibly could possibly mean, though, is that maybe we don't really have to understand an epigenetic, know that a certain variant is, or a phenotypic variant is due to an epigenetic change in order to select on it. Because as you've been selecting on the phenotypes, or even for associated genetic variants, you may be indirectly selecting for that epigenetic variant that is segregating or associated with that genetic variant. And I think an interesting example, looking at dog domestication, can kind of illustrate that. And so they were looking, so this study, they looked at differentially methylated regions between wolves and dogs, trying to get the question, what has changed in terms of the epigenome during dog domestication? And so here they're just clustering all their individuals based on the methylation differences rather than the genetic differences. And what you see is a very strong clustering of dogs with each other and wolves with each other. And when they map, look for, do scans to find methylation variants that are associated with domestication, they find significant methylation variants, and oftentimes these are associated with underlying structural differences in the genome, such as transposons and other aspects. So, if it's not practical to really use this in terms of animal breeding or selection, another possibility is that you can use things like DNA methylation or ChIP-seq or some of these histone data as a marker for predicting the performance of individuals. And so again, this is a study that came out of plants, relying in part on some of that epigroup data, where they started applying some of the genomic prediction techniques to using epigenomic data rather than using genomic data. And they were able to predict, in part, a plant height due to this epigenomic data and showed that it could work. Whether or not this is just due because it's correlated with genetic variation or not, well, actually, in that case, in the epigroup case, this is not as due to differences in genetic variation. And they found that this epigenetic variation in these epigroups accounted for 65% of the phenotypic variation. But this is a unique case just due to the way that population was created. So, the other possibility in really applying epigenomics and epigenetics is in trying to manipulate these factors to achieve some sort of positive outcome. And one way you can get at that is through environmental manipulation. So it is known that environmental factors such as diet, stress, can affect the epigenome and affect gene expression. Whether or not these are actually epigenetic and that they're inheritable, is really a matter of intense debate, but there's still the possibility that this is something that can be done. And of course, there's also factors such as imprinting of genes from either the maternal or maternal individuals. Probably the best example of this comes from mice, where there's a gene that's known as the agouti gene, where there's in mice, you have these yellow-colored mice that are very fat and obese. They're prone to all sorts of diseases. However, when these mice are fed a diet rich in methyl donors, so things like folic acid, their offspring are predominantly healthier. They're not obese. They have normal brown-colored coats. They are not as prone to diseases like the mother is. Whereas when you exclude these methyl-rich diets, it's predominantly see are in line with the original mutation. And it turns out that this is due because when you feed them these methyl-rich diets, the agouti gene is methylated and silenced. And so that new phenotype is no longer being expressed. Hence why you get normal offspring.
And so this raises this question that, you know, if you're doing something in terms of how you're raising your cattle, especially, you know, during pregnancy and onwards, in terms of diet or some other condition, you may be indirectly actually affecting its epigenome. And so that may be, at a molecular level, what you're doing, why you're seeing a difference in outcome. That's just one possibility. And so the other possibility in terms of really manipulating and using the epigenome comes down to finding ways where we can go in and actually really start messing around with it, targeting it. And so one of the first ways, and probably the easiest ways, is just kind of hit it with a chemical that's known to affect factors such as DNA methylation. So there's a few of them out there, like zebuterine or 5-beta cytidine, and these are methylation inhibitors. And when applied in very high increase in doses, you actually decrease methylation levels across the genome. And this can have effects in terms of the methylation level within genes and ultimately how genes are expressed. So this is some work from Arabidopsis that I was a part of. This is really, the practicality of this is kind of questionable because it's really, you're hitting the whole organism, the whole genome very hard. So it's not very a precise approach, but it's something that can be used to induce novel variation. And these chemicals are actually used in various cancer treatments as well. So there is practical application in terms of that. More recently, I've taken approaches of engineering the entire epigenome and genome-wide way through making transgenic plants. And for here, I'm really using evolution and phylogenetics to guide me in that. In comparing grass species to dicot species, non-grasses, I found that there were some major differences in terms of certain types of methylation, such as the CHH methylation, how it goes within genes and transposons, and also how it's distributed across the genome. So it's not really found anymore in these grass species. It's actually depleted in a lot of these heterochromatic regions. And so by introducing, and it turned out that this was due to loss of a functional gene in these grasses that's found in other species. So by reintroducing that gene into these grasses, I was able to actually alter the epigenomes to look more like non-grass species. And this is having phenotypic effects that we're now studying. Finally, what's really kind of become, you know, taken off recently are methods of targeted epigenome engineering. And so this is really adapting a lot of your genome editing technologies like TALENs and CRISPR that were mentioned earlier in this session, and adding protein domains that are capable of reading and writing DNA methylation or some of these histone marks. And so by targeting specific genes or specific regions of the epigenome, you can start to try to turn them on and turn them off using these approaches. And this has been demonstrated in mammalian cells, in this case using a TALEN that's been fused to this demethylating protein, TEC1. And they were able to decrease methylation in target genes and increase those genes' expression in a very specific manner. So finally, to conclude, one of the things I'd like to remember is that epigenetics is really this nuclear inheritance, which is not based on differences in DNA sequence. And it's distinct from epigenomics because epigenetics is really about the inheritance of phenotypic variation. Also, there are a variety of methods of analysis. Where the field is really moving is towards sequencing approaches that have the highest resolution. But one of the major limitations right now, as it is in most things, it's really just the cost of these. And so until the cost comes down significantly, this will continue to be a barrier. There's various applications of epigenetics and epigenomics, but also quite a few barriers right now in terms of the practicality of these applications, especially when you consider the biology of mammals and how they reset epigenomes. And finally, in preparing for this, I looked extensively, and it turns out there's very little work that's been done in beef cattle in terms of epigenomics. And so I think there's a lot of possibility out there and a lot of opportunity to really start exploring those questions and also to use these techniques to identify those non-coding functional regions that may have important traits. So with that, I'll happily take any questions.